Books on Tape presents My Life by William Jefferson Clinton, Volume 1, read by Michael Beck. Prologue and epilogue read by the author.
When I was a young man just out of law school and eager to get on with my life, on a whim I briefly put aside my reading preference for fiction and history and bought one of those how-to books, How to Get Control of Your Time and Your Life by Alan Lakin. The book's main point was the necessity of listing short, medium, and long-term life goals, then categorizing them in order of their importance, with the A group being the most important, the B group next, and the C the last, then listing under each goal specific activities designed to achieve them. I still have that paperback book, now almost 30 years old. And I'm sure I have that old list somewhere buried in my papers, though I can't find it. However, I do remember the A list. I wanted to be a good man, have a good marriage and children, have good friends, make a successful political life, and write a great book. Whether I'm a good man is, of course, for God to judge. I know that I'm not as good as my strongest supporters believe, or as I hope to become, nor as bad as my harshest critics assert. I have been graced beyond measure by my family life with Hillary and Chelsea. Like all families' lives, ours is not perfect, but it has been wonderful. Its flaws, as all the world knows, are mostly mine, and its continuing promise is grounded in their love. No person I know ever had more or better friends. Indeed, a strong case can be made that I rose to the presidency on the shoulders of my personal friends, the now legendary FOBs. My life in politics was a joy. I love campaigns and I love governing. I always tried to keep things moving in the right direction, to give more people a chance to live their dreams, to lift people's spirits, and to bring them together. That's the way I kept score. As for the great book, who knows? It sure is a good story.
Chapter 1. Early on the morning of August 19, 1946, I was born under a clear sky after a violent summer storm to a widowed mother in the Julia Chester Hospital in Hope, a town of about 6,000 in southwest Arkansas, 33 miles east of the Texas border at Texarkana. My mother named me William Jefferson Blythe III after my father, William Jefferson Blythe Jr., one of nine children of a poor farmer in Sherman, Texas, who died when my father was 17. According to his sisters, my father always tried to take care of them, and he grew up to be a handsome, hard-working, fun-loving man. He met my mother at Tri-State Hospital in Shreveport, Louisiana, in 1943, when she was training to be a nurse. Many times when I was growing up, I asked Mother to tell me the story of their meeting, courting, and marriage. He brought a date with some kind of medical emergency into the ward where she was working, and they talked and flirted while the other woman was being treated. On his way out of the hospital, he touched the finger on which she was wearing her boyfriend's ring and asked her if she was married. She stammered no, she was single. The next day, he sent the other woman flowers, and her heart sank. Then he called Mother for a date, explaining that he always sent flowers when he ended a relationship. 2 months later, they were married, and he was off to war. He served in a motor pool in the invasion of Italy, repairing jeeps and tanks. After the war, he returned to Hope for Mother, and they moved to Chicago, where he got back his old job as a salesman for the Manby Equipment Company. They bought a little house in the suburb of Forest Park, but couldn't move in for a couple of months, and since Mother was pregnant with me, they decided she should go home to Hope until they could get into the new house. On May 17, 1946, after moving their furniture into their new home, my father was driving from Chicago to Hope to fetch his wife. Late at night on Highway 60 outside of Sikeston, Missouri, he lost control of his car, a 1942 Buick, when the right front tire blew out on a wet road. He was thrown clear of the car but landed in or crawled into a drainage ditch dug to reclaim swampland. The ditch held 3 feet of water, When he was found after a 2-hour search, his hand was grasping a branch above the waterline. He had tried but failed to pull himself out. He drowned, only 28 years old, married 2 years and 8 months, only 7 months of which he had spent with mother. That brief sketch is about all I ever really knew about my father. All my life I have been hungry to fill in the blanks, clinging eagerly to every photo or story or scrap of paper that would tell me more of the man who gave me life. When I was about 12, sitting on my Uncle Buddy's porch in Hope, a man walked up the steps, looked at me, and said, "You're Bill Bly's son. You look just like him." I beamed for days. In 1974, I was running for Congress. It was my first race, and the local paper did a feature story on my mother. She was at her regular coffee shop early in the morning discussing the article with a lawyer friend when one of the breakfast regulars she knew only casually came up to her and said, "I was there. I was the first one at the wreck that night." He then told my mother what he had seen, including the fact that my father had retained enough consciousness or survival instinct to try to claw himself up and out of the water before he died. Mother thanked him, went out to her car and cried, then dried her tears and went to work. In 1993, on Father's Day, my first as president, the Washington Post ran a long investigative story on my father, which was followed over the next 2 months by other investigative pieces by the Associated Press and many smaller papers. The stories confirmed the things my mother and I knew. They also turned up a lot we didn't know, including the fact that my father had probably been married 3 times before he met mother, and apparently had at least 2 more children. My father's other son was identified as Leon Ritzenthaler, a retired owner of a janitorial service from Northern California. In the article, he said he had written me during the 92 campaign, but had received no reply. I don't remember hearing about his letter, and considering all the other bullets we were dodging then, it's possible that my staff kept it from me, or maybe the letter was just misplaced in the mountains of mail we were receiving. Anyway, when I read about Leon, I got in touch with him and later met him and his wife Judy during one of my stops in Northern California. We had a happy visit, and since then we've corresponded in holiday seasons. He and I look alike. His birth certificate says his father was mine, and I wish I'd known about him a long time ago. Somewhere around this time, I also received information confirming news stories about a daughter, Sharon Pettyjohn, born Sharon Lee Blythe in Kansas City in 1941, to a woman my father later divorced. She sent copies of her birth certificate, her parents' marriage license, a photo of my father, and a letter to her mother from my father asking about our baby to Betsy Wright, my former chief of staff in the governor's office. I'm sorry to say that for whatever reason, I've never met her. This news breaking in 1993 came as a shock to mother, who by then had been battling cancer for some time, but she took it all in stride. She said young people did a lot of things during the Depression and the war that people in another time might disapprove of. What mattered was that my father was the love of her life, and she had no doubt of his love for her. Whatever the facts, that's all she needed to know as her own life moved toward its end. As for me, I wasn't quite sure what to make of it all. But given the life I've led, I could hardly be surprised that my father was more complicated than the idealized pictures I had lived with for nearly a half a century. In 1994, as we headed for the celebration of the 50th anniversary of D-Day, several newspapers published a story on my father's war record with a snapshot of him in uniform. Shortly afterward, I received a letter from Umberto Baron of Netcong, New Jersey, recounting his own experiences during the war and after. He said that he was a young boy in Italy when the Americans arrived, and that he loved to go into their camp, where one soldier in particular befriended him, giving him candy and showing him how engines worked and how to repair them. He knew him only as Bill, After the war, Barron came to the United States, and inspired by what he had learned from the soldier who called him Little G.I. Joe, he opened his own garage and started a family. He told me he had lived the American dream with a thriving business and three children. He said he owed so much of his success in life to that young soldier, but hadn't had the opportunity to say goodbye then, and had often wondered what had happened to him. Then he said, "On Memorial Day of this year, I was thumbing through a copy of the New York Daily News with my morning coffee when suddenly I felt as if I was struck by lightning. There in the lower left-hand corner of the paper was a photo of Bill. I felt chills to learn that Bill was none other than the father of the President of the United States." In 1996, the children of one of my father's sisters came for the first time to our annual family Christmas party at the White House and brought me a gift, the condolence letter my aunt had received from her congressman, the great Sam Rayburn, after my father died. It's just a short form letter and appears to have been signed with the auto pen of the day, but I hugged that letter with all the glee of a six-year-old boy getting his first train set from Santa Claus. I hung it in my private office on the second floor of the White House and looked at it every night. Shortly after I left the White House, I was boarding the U.S. Air Shuttle in Washington for New York when an airline employee stopped me to say that his stepfather had just told him he had served in the war with my father and had liked him very much. I asked for the old vet's phone number and address, and the man said he didn't have it but would get it to me. I'm still waiting, hoping there will be one more human connection to my father. At the end of my presidency, I picked a few special places to say goodbye and thanks to the American people. One of them was Chicago, where Hillary was born, where I all but clinched the Democratic nomination on St. Patrick's Day, 1992, where many of my most ardent supporters live and many of my most important domestic initiatives in crime, welfare, and education were proved effective, and of course, where my parents went to live after the war. I used to joke with Hillary that if my father hadn't lost his life on that rainy Missouri highway, I would have grown up a few miles from her, and we probably never would have met. My last event was in the Palmer House Hotel, scene of the only photo I have of my parents together, taken just before Mother came back to Hope in 1946. After the speech and the goodbyes, I went into a small room where I met a woman, Mary Etta Rees, and her two daughters. She told me she had grown up and gone to high school with my mother, then had gone north to Indiana to work in a war industry, married, stayed, and raised her children. Then she gave me another precious gift, the letter my 23-year-old mother had written on her birthday to her friend, 3 weeks after my father's death, more than 54 years earlier. It was vintage Mother. In her beautiful hand, she wrote of her heartbreak and her determination to carry on. It seemed almost unbelievable at the time. But you see, I am 6 months pregnant, and the thought of our baby keeps me going and really gives me the whole world before me. My mother left me the wedding ring she gave my father, a few moving stories, and the sure knowledge that she was loving me for him too. My father left me with the feeling that I had to live for two people, and that if I did it well enough, somehow I could make up for the life he should have had. And his memory infused me, at a younger age than most, with a sense of my own mortality. The knowledge that I, too, could die young drove me both to try to drain the most out of every moment of life and to get on with the next big challenge. Even when I wasn't sure where I was going, I was always in a hurry. Chapter 2. I was born on my grandfather's birthday, a couple of weeks early, weighing in at a respectable 6 pounds 8 ounces on a 21-inch frame. Mother and I came home to her parents' house on Hervey Street in Hope, where I would spend the next 4 years. That old house seemed massive and mysterious to me then, and still holds deep memories today. The People of Hope raised the funds to restore it and fill it with old pictures, memorabilia, and period furniture. They call it the Clinton Birthplace. It certainly is the place I associate with awakening to life, to the smells of country food, to buttermilk churns, ice cream makers, washboards, and clotheslines, to my Dick and Jane readers, my first toys, including a simple length of chain I prized above them all, to strange voices talking over our party line telephone, to my first friends and the work my grandparents did. After a year or so, my mother decided she needed to go back to New Orleans to Charity Hospital, where she had done part of her nursing training, to learn to be a nurse anesthetist. In the old days, doctors had administered their own anesthetics, so there was a demand for this relatively new work, which would bring more prestige to her and more money for us. But it must have been hard on her leaving me. On the other hand, New Orleans was an amazing place after the war, full of young people, Dixieland music, and over-the-top haunts like Club My Oh My, where men in drag danced and sang as lovely ladies. I guess it wasn't a bad place for a beautiful young widow to move beyond her loss. I got to visit Mother twice when my grandmother took me on the train to New Orleans. I was only 3, but I remember 2 things clearly. First, we stayed just across Canal Street from the French Quarter in the Jung Hotel, on one of the higher floors. It was the first building more than 2 stories high I had ever been in the first real city I had ever seen. I can remember the awe I felt looking out over all the city lights at night. I don't recall what Mother and I did in New Orleans, but I'll never forget what happened one of the times I got on the train to leave. As we pulled away from the station, Mother knelt by the side of the railroad tracks and cried as she waved goodbye. I can see her there still, crying on her knees as if it were yesterday. For more than 50 years from that first trip, New Orleans has always had a special fascination for me. I love its music, food, people, and spirit. When I was 15, my family took a vacation to New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, and I got to hear Al Hurt, the great trumpeter, in his own club. At first, they wouldn't let me in because I was underage. As Mother and I were about to walk away, the doorman told us that Hurt was sitting in his car reading just around the corner, and that only he could let me in. I found him, in his Bentley, no less, tapped on the window, and made my case. He got out, took Mother and me into the club, and put us at a table near the front. He and his group played a great set. It was my first live jazz experience. Al Hurt died while I was president. I wrote his wife and told her the story, expressing my gratitude for a big man's long-ago kindness to a boy. When I was in high school, I played the tenor saxophone solo on a piece about New Orleans called Crescent City Suite. I always thought I did a better job on it because I played it with memories of my first sight of the city. When I was 21, I won a Rhodes Scholarship in New Orleans. I think I did well in the interview in part because I felt at home there. When I was a young law professor, Hillary and I had a couple of great trips to New Orleans for conventions, staying at a quaint little hotel in the French Quarter, the Cornstalk. When I was governor of Arkansas, we played in the Sugar Bowl there, losing to Alabama in one of the legendary Bear Bryant's last great victories. At least he was born and grew up in Arkansas. When I ran for president, the people of New Orleans twice gave me overwhelming victory margins, assuring Louisiana's electoral votes for our side. Now, I have seen most of the world's great cities, but New Orleans will always be special. For coffee and beignets at the morning call on the Mississippi, for the music of Aaron and Charmaine Neville, the old guys at Preservation Hall, and the memory of Al Hurt, for jogging through the French Quarter in the early morning, for amazing meals at a host of terrific restaurants with John Brough, Sheriff Harry Lee, and my other pals, and most of all, for those first memories of my mother. They are the magnets that keep pulling me down the Mississippi to New Orleans. While Mother was in New Orleans, I was in the care of my grandparents. They were incredibly conscientious about me. They loved me very much. Sadly, much better than they were able to love each other, or, in my grandmother's case, to love my mother. Of course, I was blissfully unaware of all this at the time. I just knew that I was loved. Later, when I became interested in children growing up in hard circumstances and learned something of child development from Hillary's work at the Yale Child Study Center, I came to realize how fortunate I had been. For all their own demons, my grandparents and my mother always made me feel I was the most important person in the world to them. Most children will make it if they have just one person who makes them feel that way. I had three. My grandmother, Edith Grisham Cassidy, stood just over 5 feet tall and weighed about 180 pounds. Mama was bright, intense, and aggressive, and had obviously been pretty once. She had a great laugh, but she was also full of anger and disappointment and obsessions she only dimly understood. She took it all out in raging tirades against my grandfather and my mother, both before and after I was born, though I was shielded from most of them. She had been a good student and ambitious, so after high school, she took a correspondence course in nursing from the Chicago School of Nursing. By the time I was a toddler, she was a private duty nurse for a man not far from our house on Hervey Street. I can still remember running down the sidewalk to meet her when she came home from work. Mama's main goals for me were that I would eat a lot, learn a lot, and always be neat and clean. We ate in the kitchen at a table next to the window. My high chair faced the window, and Mama tacked playing cards up on the wooden window frame at mealtimes so that I could learn to count. She also stuffed me at every meal, because conventional wisdom at the time was that a fat baby was a healthy one, as long as he bathed every day. At least once a day, she read to me from Dick and Jane books until I could read them myself, and from World Book Encyclopedia volumes, which in those days were sold door-to-door by salesmen and were often the only books besides the Bible in working people's houses. These early instructions probably explain why I now read a lot, love card games, battle my weight, and never forget to wash my hands and brush my teeth. I adored my grandfather, the first male influence in my life, and felt pride that I was born on his birthday. James Eldridge Cassidy was a slight man, about 5'8", but in those years still strong and handsome. I always thought he resembled the actor Randolph Scott. When my grandparents moved from Bodcaw, which had a population of about 100, to the metropolis Hope, Papaw worked for an ice house delivering ice on a horse-drawn wagon. In those days, refrigerators really were ice boxes, cooled by chunks of ice whose size varied according to the size of the appliance. Though he weighed about 150 pounds, my grandfather carried ice blocks that weighed up to 100 pounds or more, using a pair of hooks to slide them onto his back, which was protected by a large leather flap. My grandfather was an incredibly kind and generous man. During the Depression, when nobody had any money, he would invite boys to ride the ice truck with him just to get them off the street. They earned 25 cents a day. In 1976, when I was in Hope running for Attorney General, I had a talk with one of those boys, Judge John Wilson. He grew up to be a distinguished, successful lawyer, but he still had vivid memories of those days. He told me that at the end of one day, when my grandfather gave him his quarter, he asked if he could have 2 dimes and a nickel, so that he could feel he had more money. He got them and walked home jingling the change in his pockets, but he jingled too hard, and one of the dimes fell out. He looked for that dime for hours to no avail. 40 years later, he told me he still never walked by that stretch of sidewalk without trying to spot that dime. It's hard to convey to young people today the impact the Depression had on my parents' and grandparents' generation. But I grew up feeling it. One of the most memorable stories of my childhood was my mother's tale of a Depression Good Friday, when my grandfather came home from work and broke down and cried as he told her he just couldn't afford the dollar or so it would cost to buy her a new Easter dress. She never forgot it, and every year of my childhood, I had a new Easter outfit whether I wanted it or not. I remember one Easter in the 1950s when I was fat and self-conscious. I went to church in a light-colored short-sleeved shirt, white linen pants, pink and black hush puppies, and a matching pink suede belt. It hurt, but my mother had been faithful to her father's Easter ritual. When I was living with him, my grandfather had two jobs that I really loved. He ran a little grocery store, and he supplemented his income by working as a night watchman at a sawmill. I loved spending the night with Papaw at the sawmill. We would take a paper bag with sandwiches for supper, and I would sleep in the back seat of the car. And on clear, starlit nights, I would climb in the sawdust piles, taking in the magical smells of fresh-cut timber and sawdust. My grandfather loved working there, too. It got him out of the house and reminded him of the mill work he had done as a young man around the time of my mother's birth. Except for the time Papaw closed the car door on my fingers in the dark, those nights were perfect adventures. The grocery store was a different sort of adventure. First, there was a huge jar of Jackson's cookies on the counter, which I raided with gusto. Second, grown-ups I didn't know came in to buy groceries, for the first time exposing me to adults who weren't relatives. Third, a lot of my grandfather's customers were black. Though the South was completely segregated back then, some level of racial interaction was inevitable in small towns, just as it had always been in the rural South. However, it was rare to find an uneducated rural Southerner without a racist bone in his body. That's exactly what my grandfather was. I could see that black people looked different, but because he treated them like he did everybody else, asking after their children and about their work, I thought they were just like me. Occasionally, black kids would come into the store and we would play. It took me years to learn about segregation and prejudice and the meaning of poverty, years to learn that most white people weren't like my grandfather and grandmother, whose views on race were among the few things she had in common with her husband. In fact, Mother told me one of the worst whippings she ever got was when at age 3 or 4, she called a black woman nigger. To put it mildly, Mama's whipping her was an unusual reaction for a poor Southern white woman in the 1920s. My mother once told me that after Papaw died, she found some of his old account books from the grocery store with lots of unpaid bills from his customers, most of them black. She recalled that he had told her that good people who were doing the best they could deserved to be able to feed their families, and no matter how strapped he was, he never denied them groceries on credit. Maybe that's why I've always believed in food stamps. After I became president, I got another first-hand account of my grandfather's store. In 1997, an African-American woman, Ernestine Campbell, did an interview for her hometown paper in Toledo, Ohio, about her grandfather buying groceries from Papaw on account and bringing her with him to the store. She said that she remembered playing with me and that I was the only white boy in that neighborhood who played with black kids. Thanks to my grandfather, I didn't know I was the only white kid who did that. Besides my grandfather's store, my neighborhood provided my only other contact with people outside my family. I experienced a lot in those narrow confines. I saw a house burn down across the street and learned I was not the only person bad things happened to. I made friends with a boy who collected strange creatures, and once he invited me over to see his snake. He said it was in the closet. Then he opened the closet door, shoved me into the darkness, slammed the door shut, and told me I was in the dark alone with the snake. I wasn't, thank goodness, but I was sure scared to death. I learned that what seems funny to the strong can be cruel and humiliating to the weak. Our house was just a block away from a railroad underpass, which then was made of rough tar-coated timbers. I liked to climb on the timbers, listen to the trains rattle overhead, and wonder where they were going and whether I would ever go there. And I used to play in the backyard with a boy whose yard adjoined mine. He lived with two beautiful sisters in a bigger, nicer house than ours. We used to sit on the grass for hours, throwing his knife in the ground and learning to make it stick. His name was Vince Foster. He was kind to me and never lorded it over me the way so many older boys did with younger ones. He grew up to be a tall, handsome, wise, good man. He became a great lawyer and a strong supporter early in my career and Hillary's best friend at the Rose Law Firm. Our family socialized in Little Rock, mostly at his house, where his wife Lisa taught Chelsea to swim. He came to the White House with us and was a voice of calm and reason in those crazy early months. There was one other person outside the family who influenced me in my early childhood. Odessa was a black woman who came to our house to clean, cook, and watch me when my grandparents were at work. She had big buck teeth, which made her smile only brighter and more beautiful to me. I kept up with her for years after I left Hope. In 1966, a friend and I went out to see Odessa after visiting my father's and grandfather's graves. Most of the black people in Hope lived near the cemetery across the road from where my grandfather's store had been. I remember visiting on her porch for a good long while. When the time came to go, we got in my car and drove away on dirt streets. The only unpaved streets I saw in Hope, or later in Hot Springs when I moved there, were in black neighborhoods, full of people who worked hard, many of them raising kids like me, and who paid taxes. Odessa deserved better. The other large figures in my childhood were relatives, my maternal great-grandparents, my great-aunt Ottie, and my great-uncle Carl Russell, and most of all, my great-uncle Orrin, known as Buddy, and one of the lights of my life, and his wife, Aunt Ollie. My Grisham great-grandparents lived out in the country in a little wooden house built up off the ground. Because Arkansas gets more tornadoes than almost any other place in the United States, most people who lived in virtual stick houses like theirs dug a hole in the ground for a storm cellar. Theirs was out in the front yard and had a little bed and a small table with a coal oil lantern on it. I still remember peering into that little space and hearing my great-grandfather say, "Yes, sometimes snakes go down there too, but they won't bite you if the lantern's lit." I never found out whether that was true or not. My only other memory of my great-grandfather is that he came to visit me in the hospital when I broke my leg at age 5. He held my hand and we posed for a picture. He's in a simple black jacket and a white shirt buttoned all the way up, looking old as the hills, straight out of American Gothic. My grandmother's sister Opal, we called her Ottie, was a fine-looking woman with the great Grisham family laugh, whose quiet husband Carl was the first person I knew who grew watermelons. The river-enriched sandy soil around Hope is ideal for them, and the size of Hope's melons became the trademark of the town in the early 50s when the community sent the largest melon ever grown up to that time, just under 200 pounds, to President Truman. The better-tasting melons, however, weigh 60 pounds or less. Those are the ones I saw my great-uncle Carl grow, pouring water from a wash tub into the soil around the melons and watching the stalks suck it up like a vacuum cleaner. When I became president, Uncle Carl's cousin, Carter Russell, still had a watermelon stand in Hope where you could get good red or the sweeter yellow melons. Hillary says the first time she ever saw me, I was in the Yale Law School lounge bragging to skeptical fellow students about the size of Hope watermelons. When I was president, my old friends from Hope put on a watermelon feed on the south lawn of the White House, and I got to tell my watermelon stories to a new generation of young people who pretended to be interested in a subject I began to learn about so long ago from Aunt Ottie and Uncle Carl. My grandmother's brother, Uncle Buddy, and his wife, Ollie, were the primary members of my extended family. Buddy and Ollie had 4 children, 3 of whom were gone from Hope by the time I came along. Dwayne was an executive with a shoe manufacturer in New Hampshire, Conrad and Falba were living in Dallas, though they both came back to Hope often and live there today. Myra, the youngest, was a rodeo queen. She could ride like a pro, and she later ran off with a cowboy, had two boys, divorced, and moved home where she ran the local housing authority. Myra and Falba are great women who laugh through their tears and never quit on family and friends. I'm glad they are still part of my life. I spent a lot of time at Buddy and Ollie's house, not just in my first 6 years in Hope, but for 40 more years, until Ollie died and Buddy sold the house and moved in with Falba. Social life in my extended family, like that of most people of modest means who grew up in the country, revolved around meals, conversation, and storytelling. They couldn't afford vacations, rarely if ever went to the movies, and didn't have television until the mid to late 1950s. They went out a few times a year, to the country fair, the watermelon festival, the occasional square dance or gospel singing. The men hunted and fished and raised vegetables and watermelon on small plots out in the country that they had kept when they moved to town to work. Though they never had extra money, they never felt poor as long as they had a neat house, clean clothes, and enough food to feed anyone who came in the front door. They worked to live, not the other way around. My favorite childhood meals were at Buddy and Ollie's, eating around a big table in their small kitchen. A typical weekend lunch, which we called dinner, the evening meal was supper, included ham or a roast, cornbread, spinach or collard greens, mashed potatoes, sweet potatoes, peas, green beans or lima beans, fruit pie, and endless quantities of iced tea we drank in large goblet-like glasses. I felt more grown up drinking out of those big glasses. On special days, we had homemade ice cream to go with the pie. When I was there early enough, I got to help prepare the meal, shelling the beans or turning the crank on the ice cream maker. Before, during, and after dinner, there was constant talk. Town gossip, family goings-on, and stories. Lots of them. All my kinfolks could tell a story. Making simple events, encounters, and mishaps involving ordinary people come alive with drama and laughter. Buddy was the best storyteller. Like both of his sisters, he was very bright. I often wondered what he and they would have made of their lives if they had been born into my generation or my daughter's. But there were lots of people like them back then. The guy pumping your gas might have an IQ as high as the guy taking your tonsils out. There are still people like the Grishams in America. Many of them new immigrants, which is why I tried as president to open the doors of college to all comers. Though he had a very limited education, Buddy had a fine mind and a Ph.D. in human nature, born of a lifetime of keen observation and dealing with his own demons and those of his family. Early in his marriage, he had a drinking problem. One day he came home and told his wife he knew his drinking was hurting her and their family, and he was never going to drink again. And he never did, for more than 50 years. Well into his 80s, Buddy could tell amazing stories, highlighting the personalities of dogs he'd had 5 or 6 decades earlier. He remembered their names, their looks, their peculiar habits, how he came by them, the precise way they retrieved shot birds. Lots of people would come by his house and sit on the porch for a visit. After they left, he'd have a story about them or their kids, sometimes funny, sometimes sad, usually sympathetic, always understanding. I learned a lot from the stories my uncle, aunts, and grandparents told me. That no one is perfect, but most people are good. That people can't be judged only by their worst or weakest moments. That harsh judgments can make hypocrites of us all. That a lot of life is just showing up and hanging on. That laughter is often the best and sometimes the only response to pain. Perhaps most important, I learned that everyone has a story of dreams and nightmares, hope and heartache, love and loss, courage and fear, sacrifice, and selfishness. All my life, I've been interested in other people's stories. I've wanted to know them, understand them, feel them. When I grew up and got into politics, I always felt the main point of my work was to give people a chance to have better stories. Uncle Buddy's story was good until the end. He got lung cancer in 1974, had a lung removed, and still lived to be 91. He counseled me in my political career, and if I'd followed his advice and repealed an unpopular car tag increase, I probably wouldn't have lost my first gubernatorial reelection campaign in 1980. He lived to see me elected president and got a big kick out of it. After Ollie died, he kept active by going down to his daughter Falba's donut shop and regaling a whole new generation of kids with his stories and witty observations on the human condition. He never lost his sense of humor. He was still driving at 87 when he took two lady friends, aged 91 and 93, for drives separately once a week. When he told me about his dates, I asked, "So you like these older women now?" He snickered and said, "Yeah, I do. Seems like they're a little more settled." In all our years together, I saw my uncle cry only once. Ollie developed Alzheimer's and had to be moved to a nursing home. For several weeks afterward, she knew who she was for a few minutes a day. During those lucid intervals, she would call Buddy and say, "Oren, how could you leave me in this place after 56 years of marriage? Come get me right now." He would dutifully drive over to see her, but by the time he got there, she would be lost again in the mists of the disease and didn't know him. It was during this period that I stopped by to see him late one afternoon, our last visit at the old house. I was hoping to cheer him up. Instead, he made me laugh with bawdy jokes and droll comments on current events. When darkness fell, I told him I had to go back to Little Rock. He followed me to the door, and as I was about to walk out, he grabbed my arm. I turned and saw tears in his eyes for the first and only time in almost 50 years of love and friendship. I said, "This is really hard, isn't it?" I'll never forget his reply. He smiled and said, "Yeah, it is, but I signed on for the whole load, and most of it was pretty good." My Uncle Buddy taught me that everyone has a story. He told his in that one sentence. Chapter 3. After a year in New Orleans, Mother came home to Hope, eager to put her anesthesia training into practice, elated at being reunited with me and back to her old fun-loving self. She had dated several men in New Orleans and had a fine time, according to her memoir, Leading with My Heart, which I'm sure would have been a bestseller if she had lived to promote it. However, before, during, and after her sojourn in New Orleans, Mother was dating one man more than anyone else, the owner of the local Buick dealership, Roger Clinton. She was a beautiful, high-spirited widow. He was a handsome, hell-raising, twice-divorced man from Hot Springs, Arkansas Sin City, which for several years had been home to the largest illegal gambling operation in the United States. Roger's brother, Raymond, owned the Buick dealership in Hot Springs, and Roger, the baby and bad boy of a family of five, had come to Hope to take advantage of the war activity around the southwestern proving ground and perhaps to get out of his brother's shadow. Roger loved to drink and party with his two best buddies from Hot Springs, Van Hampton Lyle, who owned the Coca-Cola bottling plant across the street from Clinton Buick, and Gabe Crawford, who owned several drugstores in Hot Springs and one in Hope, later built Hot Springs' first shopping center, and was then married to Roger's gorgeous niece, Virginia, a woman I've always loved, who was the very first Miss Hot Springs. Their idea of a good time was to gamble, get drunk, and do crazy, reckless things in cars or airplanes or on motorcycles. It's a wonder they didn't all die young. Mother liked Roger because he was fun, paid attention to me, and was generous. He paid for her to come home to see me several times when she was in New Orleans, and he probably paid for the train trips Mama and I took to see Mother. Papa liked Roger because he was nice both to me and to him. For a while after my grandfather quit the ice house because of severe bronchial problems, he ran a liquor store. Near the end of the war, Hempstead County, of which Hope is the county seat, voted to go dry. That's when my grandfather opened his grocery store. I later learned that Papa sold liquor under the counter to doctors, lawyers, and other respectable people who didn't want to drive the 33 miles to the nearest legal liquor store in Texarkana, and that Roger was his supplier. Mama really disliked Roger because she thought he was not the kind of man her daughter and grandson should be tied to. She had a dark side her husband and daughter lacked, but it enabled her to see the darkness in others that they missed. She thought Roger Clinton was nothing but trouble. She was right about the trouble part, but not the nothing but. There was more to him than that, which makes his story even sadder. As for me, all I knew was that he was good to me and had a big brown and black German shepherd, Susie, that he brought to play with me. Susie was a big part of my childhood and started my lifelong love affair with dogs. Mother and Roger got married in Hot Springs in June 1950, shortly after her 27th birthday. Only Gabe and Virginia Crawford were there. Then Mother and I left her parents' home and moved with my new stepfather, whom I soon began to call Daddy, into a little white wooden house on the south end of town at 321 13th Street at the corner of Walker Street. Not long afterward, I started calling myself Billy Clinton. My new world was exciting to me. Next door were Ned and Alice Williams. Mr. Ned was a retired railroad worker who built a workshop behind his house filled with a large, sophisticated model electric train setup. Back then, every little kid wanted a Lionel train set. Daddy got me one, and we used to play with it together, but nothing could compare to Mr. Ned's large, intricate tracks and beautiful, fast trains. I spent hours there. It was like having my own Disneyland next door. My neighborhood was a Class A advertisement for the post-World War II baby boom. There were lots of young couples with kids. Across the street lived the most special child of all, Mitzi Polk, daughter of Minor and Margaret Polk. Mitzi had a loud, roaring laugh. She would swing so high in her swing set, the poles of the frame would come up out of the ground as she bellowed at the top of her lungs. "Billy sucks a bottle! Billy sucks a bottle!" She drove me nuts. After all, I was getting to be a big boy, and I did no such thing. I later learned that Mitzi was developmentally disabled. The term wouldn't have meant anything to me then, but when I pushed to expand opportunities for the disabled as governor and president, I thought often of Mitzi Polk. A lot happened to me while I lived on 13th Street. I started school at Miss Marie Perkins School for Little Folks Kindergarten, which I loved until I broke my leg one day jumping rope. And it wasn't even a moving rope. The rope in the playground was tied at one end to a tree and at the other end to a swing set. The kids would line up on one side and take turns running and jumping over it. All the other kids cleared the rope. One of them was Mac McClarty, son of the local Ford dealer, later governor of Boys State, all-star quarterback, state legislator, successful businessman, and then my first White House chief of staff. Mac always cleared every hurdle. Luckily for me, he always waited for me to catch up. Me? I didn't clear the rope. I was a little chunky anyway and slow, so slow that I was once the only kid at the Easter egg hunt who didn't get a single egg, not because I couldn't find them, but because I couldn't get to them fast enough. On the day I tried to jump rope, I was wearing cowboy boots to school. Like a fool, I didn't take the boots off to jump. My heel caught on the rope. I turned, fell, and heard my leg snap. I lay in agony on the ground for several minutes while Daddy raced over from the Buick place to get me. I had broken my leg above the knee, and because I was growing so fast, the doctor was reluctant to put me in a cast up to my hip. Instead, he made a hole through my ankle, pushed a stainless steel bar through it, attached it to a stainless steel horseshoe, and hung my leg up in the air over my hospital bed. I lay like that for 2 months, flat on my back, feeling both foolish and pleased to be out of school and receiving so many visitors. I took a long time getting over that leg break. After I got out of the hospital, my folks bought me a bicycle. But I never lost my fear of riding without the training wheels. As a result, I never stopped feeling that I was clumsy and without a normal sense of balance until at the age of 22, I finally started riding a bike at Oxford. Even then, I fell a few times, but I thought of it as building my pain threshold. I was grateful to Daddy for coming to rescue me when I broke my leg. He also came home from work a time or two to try to talk Mother out of spanking me when I did something wrong. At the beginning of their marriage, he really tried to be there for me. I remember once he even took me on the train to St. Louis to see the Cardinals, then our nearest Major League Baseball team. We stayed overnight and came home the next day. I loved it. Sadly, it was the only trip the two of us ever took together. Like the only time we ever went fishing together. The only time we ever went out into the woods to cut our own Christmas tree together. The only time our whole family took an out-of-state vacation together. There were so many things that meant a lot to me, but were never to occur again. Roger Clinton really loved me, and he loved Mother, but he couldn't ever quite break free of the shadows of self-doubt, the phony security of binge drinking and adolescent partying, and the isolation from and verbal abuse of Mother that kept him from becoming the man he might have been. One night his drunken self-destructiveness came to a head in a fight with my mother I can't ever forget. Mother wanted us to go to the hospital to see my great-grandmother, who didn't have long to live. Daddy said she couldn't go. They were screaming at each other in their bedroom in the back of the house. For some reason, I walked out into the hall to the doorway of the bedroom. Just as I did, Daddy pulled a gun from behind his back and fired in Mother's direction. The bullet went into the wall between where she and I were standing. I was stunned and so scared. I had never heard a shot fired before, much less seen one. Mother grabbed me and ran across the street to the neighbors. The police were called. I can still see them leading Daddy away in handcuffs to jail, where he spent the night. I'm sure Daddy didn't mean to hurt her, and he would have died if the bullet had accidentally hit either of us. But something more poisonous than alcohol drove him to that level of debasement. It would be a long time before I could understand such forces in others or in myself. When Daddy got out of jail, he had sobered up in more ways than one and was so ashamed that nothing bad happened for some time. I had one more year of life and schooling in hope. I went to first grade at Brookwood School. My teacher was Miss Mary Wilson. Although she only had one arm, she didn't believe in sparing the rod, or in her case, the paddle, into which she had bored holes to cut down on the wind resistance. On more than one occasion, I was the recipient of her concern. In addition to my neighbors and Mac McClarty, I became friends with some other kids who stayed with me for a lifetime. One of them, Joe Purvis, had a childhood that made mine look idyllic. He grew up to be a fine lawyer, and when I was elected Attorney General, I hired Joe on my staff. When Arkansas had an important case before the U.S. Supreme Court, I went but let Joe make the argument. Justice Byron Whizzer White sent me a note from the bench saying that Joe had done a good job. Later, Joe became the first chairman of my Birthplace Foundation. Besides my friends and family, my life on 13th Street was marked by my discovery of the movies. In 1951 and 1952, I could go for a dime, a nickel to get in, a nickel for a Coke. I went every couple of weeks or so. Back then, you got a feature film, a cartoon, a serial, and a newsreel. The Korean War was on, so I learned about that. Flash Gordon and Rocket Man were the big serial heroes. For cartoons, I preferred Bugs Bunny, Casper the Friendly Ghost, and Baby Huey, with whom I probably identified. I saw a lot of movies, and especially liked the westerns. My favorite was High Noon. I probably saw it half a dozen times during its run in Hope, and have seen it more than a dozen times since. It's still my favorite movie, because it's not your typical macho western. I love the movie because from start to finish, Gary Cooper is scared to death, but does the right thing anyway. When I was elected president, I told an interviewer that my favorite movie was High Noon. At the time, Fred Zinnemann, its director, was nearly 90, living in London. I got a great letter from him with a copy of his annotated script and an autographed picture of himself with Cooper and Grace Kelly in street clothes on the High Noon set in 1951. Over the long years since I first saw High Noon, when I face my own showdowns, I often thought of the look in Gary Cooper's eyes as he stares into the face of almost certain defeat, and how he keeps walking through his fears toward his duty. It works pretty well in real life, too. Chapter 4. In the summer after my first grade year, Daddy decided he wanted to go home to Hot Springs. He sold the Buick dealership and moved us to a 400-acre farm out on Wildcat Road a few miles west of the city. It had cattle, sheep, and goats. What it didn't have was an indoor toilet. So for the year or so we lived out there, on the hottest summer days and the coldest winter nights, we had to go outside to the wooden outhouse to relieve ourselves. It was an interesting experience, especially when the non-poisonous kingsnake that hung around our yard was peering up through the hole at me when I had to go. Later, when I got into politics, being able to say I had lived on a farm with an outhouse made a great story, almost as good as being born in a log cabin. I liked living on the farm, feeding the animals and moving among them, until one fateful Sunday. Daddy had several members of his family out to lunch, including his brother Raymond and his children. I took one of Raymond's daughters, Carla, out into the field where the sheep were grazing. I knew there was one mean ram we had to avoid, but we decided to tempt fate. A big mistake. When we were about 100 yards away from the fence, the ram saw us and started to charge. We started running for the fence. Carla was bigger and faster and made it. I stumbled over a big rock. When I fell, I could see I wasn't going to make the fence before the ram got to me, so I retreated to a small tree a few feet away in the hope I could keep away from him by running around the tree until help came. Another big mistake. Soon he caught me and knocked my legs out from under me. Before I could get up, he butted me in the head. Then I was stunned and hurt and couldn't get up. So he backed up, got a good head start, and rammed me again as hard as he could. He did the same thing over and over and over again, alternating his targets between my head and my gut. Soon I was pouring blood and hurting like the devil. After what seemed an eternity, my uncle showed up, picked up a big rock, and threw it hard, hitting the ram square between the eyes. The ram just shook his head and walked off, apparently unfazed. I recovered, left with only a scar on my forehead, which gradually grew into my scalp. And I learned that I could take a hard hit, a lesson that I would relearn a couple of more times in my childhood and later in life. A few months after we moved to the farm, both my folks were going to town to work. Daddy gave up on being a farmer and took a job as a parts manager for Uncle Raymond's Buick dealership, while Mother found more anesthesia work in Hot Springs than she could handle. One day on the way to work, she picked up a woman who was walking to town. After they got acquainted, Mother asked her if she knew anyone who would come to the house and look after me while she and Daddy were at work. In one of the great moments of good luck in my life, she suggested herself. Her name was Cora Walters. She was a grandmother with every good quality of an old-fashioned countrywoman. She was wise, kind, upright, conscientious, and deeply Christian. She became a member of our family for 11 years. All her family were good people, and after she left us, her daughter, May Hightower, came to work for Mother and stayed 30 more years until Mother died. In another age, Cora Walters would have made a fine minister. She made me a better person by her example and certainly wasn't responsible for any of my sins, then or later. She was a tough old gal, too. One day she helped me kill a huge rat that was hanging around our house. Actually, I found it and she killed it while I cheered. When we moved out to the country, Mother was concerned about my going to a small rural school, so she enrolled me in St. John's Catholic School downtown, where I attended second and third grade. Both years, my teacher was Sister Mary Amata McGee, a fine and caring teacher, but no pushover. I often got straight A's on my six-week report card and a C in citizenship, which was a euphemism for good behavior in class. I loved to read and compete in spelling contest, but I talked too much. It was a constant problem in grade school, and as my critics and many of my friends would say, it's one I never quite got over. I also got into trouble once for excusing myself to go to the bathroom and staying away too long during the daily rosary. I was fascinated by the Catholic Church, its rituals, and the devotion of the nuns, but getting on my knees on the seat of my desk and leaning on the back with the rosary beads was often too much for a rambunctious boy whose only church experience before then had been in the Sunday school and the summer vacation Bible school of the First Baptist Church of Hope. After a year or so on the farm, Daddy decided to move into Hot Springs. He rented a big house from Uncle Raymond at 1011 Park Avenue in the east end of town. He led Mother to believe he'd made a good deal for it and had bought the house with his income and hers, but even with their two incomes and with housing costs a considerably smaller part of the average family's expenses than now, I can't see how he could have afforded it. The house was up on a hill. It had two stories, five bedrooms, and a fascinating little ballroom upstairs with a bar on which stood a big rotating cage with two huge dice in it. Apparently, the first owner had been in the gambling business. I spent many happy hours in that room, having parties or just playing with my friends. The exterior of the house was white with green trim, with sloping roofs over the front entrance and the two sides. The front yard was terraced on three levels with a sidewalk down the middle and a rock wall between the middle and ground levels. The side yards were small but large enough for Mother to indulge her favorite outdoor hobby, gardening. She especially loved to grow roses and did so in all her homes until she died. Mother tanned easily and deeply, and she got most of her tan while digging dirt around her flowers in a tank top and shorts. The back had a gravel driveway with a four-car garage, a nice lawn with a swing set, and on both sides of the driveway, sloping lawns that went down to the street. Circle Drive. We lived in that house from the time I was 7 or 8 until I was 15. It was fascinating to me. The grounds were full of shrubs, bushes, flowers, long hedges laced with honeysuckle, and lots of trees, including a fig, a pear, two crab apples, and a huge old oak in the front. I helped Daddy take care of the grounds. It was one thing we did do together, though as I got older, I did more and more of it myself. The house was near a wooded area, so I was always running across spiders, tarantulas, centipedes, scorpions, wasps, hornets, bees, and snakes, along with more benign creatures like squirrels, chipmunks, blue jays, robins, and woodpeckers. Once, when I was mowing the lawn, I looked down to see a rattlesnake sliding along with the lawnmower, apparently captivated by the vibrations. I didn't like the vibes, so I ran like crazy and escaped unscathed. Another time I wasn't so lucky. Daddy had put up a huge three-story birdhouse for martins, which nest in groups, at the bottom of the back driveway. One day I was mowing grass down there and discovered it had become a nesting place not for martins, but for bumblebees. They swarmed me, flying all over my body, my arms, my face. Amazingly, not one of them stung me. I ran off to catch my breath and consider my options. Mistakenly, I assumed they had decided I meant them no harm, so after a few minutes I went back to my mowing. I hadn't gone 10 yards before they swarmed me again, this time stinging me all over my body. One got caught between my belly and my belt, stinging me over and over, something bumblebees can do that honeybees can't. I was delirious and had to be rushed to the doctor, but recovered soon enough with another valuable lesson. Tribes of bumblebees give intruders one fair warning, but not two. More than 35 years later, Kate Ross, the 5-year-old daughter of my friends Michael Ross and Marky Post, sent me a letter that said simply, "Bees can sting you. Watch out." I knew just what she meant. My move to Hot Springs gave my life many new experiences. A new, much larger and more sophisticated city, a new neighborhood, a new school, new friends, and my introduction to music. My first serious religious experience in a new church, and of course, a new extended family in the Clinton clan. The hot sulfur springs, for which the city is named, bubble up from below ground in a narrow gap in the Ouachita Mountains, a little more than 50 miles west and slightly south of Little Rock. The first European to see them was Hernando de Soto, who came through the valley in 1541, saw the Indians bathing in the steaming springs, and legend has it, thought he had discovered the Fountain of Youth. In 1832, President Andrew Jackson signed a bill to protect 4 sections of land around Hot Springs as a federal reservation, the first such bill Congress ever enacted, well before the National Park Service was established or Yellowstone became our first national park. Soon, more hotels sprung up to house visitors. By the 1880s, Central Avenue, the main street snaking a mile and a half or so through the gap in the mountains where the springs were, was sprouting beautiful bathhouses as more than 100,000 people a year were taking baths for everything from rheumatism to paralysis to malaria to venereal disease to general relaxation. In the first quarter of the 20th century, the grandest bathhouses were built. More than 1 million baths a year were taken, and the spa city became known around the world. After its status was changed from federal reservation to national park, Hot Springs became the only city in America that was actually in one of our national parks. The city's attraction was amplified by grand hotels, an opera house, and beginning in the mid-19th century, gambling. By the 1880s, there were several open gambling houses, and Hot Springs was on its way to being both an attractive spa and a notorious town. For decades before and during World War II, it was run by a boss worthy of any big city, Mayor Leo McLaughlin. He ran the gambling with the help of a mobster who moved down from New York, Owen Vincent Oney Madden. After the war, a GI ticket of reformers headed by Sid McMath broke McLaughlin's power in a move that soon after made the 35-year-old McMath the nation's youngest governor. Notwithstanding the GI reformers, however, gambling continued to operate with payoffs to state and local politicians and law enforcement officials well into the 1960s. Oney Madden lived in Hot Springs as a respectable citizen for the rest of his life. Mother once put him to sleep for surgery. She came home afterward and laughingly told me that looking at his x-ray was like visiting a planetarium. The 12 bullets still in his body reminded her of shooting stars. Ironically, because it was illegal, the mafia never took over gambling in Hot Springs. Instead, we had our own local bosses. Sometimes the competing interests fought, but in my time the violence was always controlled. For example, the garages of two houses were bombed, but at a time when no one was home. For the last three decades of the 19th century and the first five of the 20th, gambling drew an amazing array of characters to town. Outlaws, mobsters, military heroes, actors, and a host of baseball greats. The legendary pool shark Minnesota Fats came often. In 1977, as Attorney General, I shot pool with him for a charity in Hot Springs. He killed me in the game, but made up for it by regaling me with stories of long-ago visits. When he played the horses by day, then ate and gambled up and down Central Avenue all night, adding to his pocketbook and his famous waistline. Hot Springs drew politicians, too. William Jennings Bryan came several times, so did Teddy Roosevelt in 1910, Herbert Hoover in 1927, and Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt for the state centennial in 1936. Huey Long had a second honeymoon with his wife there. JFK and Lyndon Johnson visited before they were presidents. So did Harry Truman, the only one who gambled. At least the only one who didn't hide it. The gambling and hot water attractions of Hot Springs were enhanced by large, brightly lit auction houses, which alternated with gambling spots and restaurants on Central Avenue on the other side of the street from the bathhouses.
End of Disc 1. Disc 2.
The gambling and hot water attractions of Hot Springs were enhanced by large, brightly lit auction houses, which alternated with gambling spots and restaurants on Central Avenue on the other side of the street from the bathhouses. By Oaklawn Racetrack, which offered fine thoroughbred racing for 30 days a year in the spring, the only legal gambling in the city. By slot machines in many of the restaurants, some of which even kids were allowed to play if they were sitting on their parents' laps, and by three lakes near the city, the most important of which was Lake Hamilton, where many of the city's grandees, including Uncle Raymond, had large houses. Thousands of people flocked to the lake's motels for summer vacation. There was also an alligator farm, in which the largest resident was 18 feet long. An ostrich farm, whose residents sometimes paraded down Central Avenue. Keller Breland's IQ Zoo, full of animals and featuring the alleged skeleton of a mermaid. And a notorious whorehouse run by Maxine Harris, later Maxine Temple Jones, a real character who openly deposited her payoffs in the local authorities' bank accounts and who in 1983 wrote an interesting book about her life. Call Me Madam, The Life and Times of a Hot Springs Madam. When I was 10 or 11, on a couple of occasions my friends and I entertained ourselves for hours by calling Maxine's place over and over, tying up her phone and blocking calls from real customers. It infuriated her, and she cursed us out with salty and creative language we'd never heard before from a woman, or a man for that matter. It was hilarious. I think she thought it was funny, too, at least for the first 15 minutes or so. For Arkansas, a state composed mostly of white Southern Baptists and blacks, Hot Springs was amazingly diverse, especially for a town of only 35,000. There was a good-sized black population and a hotel, the Knights of the Pythias, for black visitors. There were two Catholic churches and two synagogues. The Jewish residents owned some of the best stores and ran the auction houses. The best toy store in town was Ricky's, named by the Silvermans after their son, who was in the band with me. Lowry's, the jewelry store where I bought little things for Mother, was owned by Marty and Laura Fleischner. And there was the B'nai B'rith's Leo N. Levi Hospital, which used the hot springs to treat arthritis. I also met my first Arab Americans in Hot Springs, the Zarabs and the Hassins. When David Zarab's parents were killed in Lebanon, he was adopted by his uncle. He came to this country at 9, unable to speak any English, and eventually became valedictorian of his class and governor of Boys State. Now he is a neurosurgeon in Pennsylvania. Guido Hassin and his sisters were the children of the World War II romance of a Syrian American and an Italian woman. They were my neighbors during high school. I also had a Japanese American friend, Albert Hahn, and a Czech classmate, René Duchek, whose emigre parents owned a restaurant, the Little Bohemia. There was a large Greek community, which included a Greek Orthodox church and Angelo's, a restaurant just around the corner from Clinton Buick. It was a great old-fashioned place, with its long soda fountain-like bar and tables covered with red and white checked tablecloths. The house specialty was a three-way, chili, beans, and spaghetti. My best Greek friends by far were the Leopoulos family. George ran a little cafe on Bridge Street between Central Avenue and Broadway, which we claimed was the shortest street in America, stretching all of a third of a block. George's wife, Evelyn, was a tiny woman who believed in reincarnation, collected antiques, and loved Liberace, who thrilled her by coming to her house for dinner once while he was performing in Hot Springs. The younger Leopoulos son, Paul David, became my best friend in fourth grade and has been like my brother ever since. When we were boys, I loved to go with him to his dad's cafe, especially when the carnival was in town, because all the carnies ate there. Once they gave us free tickets to all the rides. We used every one of them, making David happy and me dizzy and sick to my stomach. After that, I stuck to bumper cars and Ferris wheels. We've shared a lifetime of ups and downs and enough laughs for three lifetimes. That I had friends and acquaintances from such a diverse group of people when I was young may seem normal today. But in 1950s Arkansas, it could have happened only in Hot Springs. Even so, most of my friends and I led pretty normal lives, apart from the occasional calls to Maxine's bordello and the temptation to cut classes during racing season, which I never did, but which proved irresistible to some of my classmates in high school.